Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning at verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. You may be seated. I know that the very beginning of the sermons have been redundant, but it is so important for us to get this. I really feel like this is one of those passages of Scripture that I could pause and repeat the sermons on for the next 52 weeks. When Jesus is asked what is the greatest commandment, his response is the Shema. And then he says, the second one is like it. And ironically, the second one we find in Deuteronomy being fleshed out, to love others as yourself. And so if we can't get this, we will struggle in our Christian journey for the entirety of our life. And so the Shema, hear, O Israel. Do what? Do what? Listen and hear. Hear, O Israel, do what? Hear and respond. Listen and respond. It is not just class. You don't get to just take information in. The Shema is a responsive call. Hear, O Israel. Listen, let it soak in, and then flesh it out and live it out. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, implying that he is not two or three gods, but in three. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one God in three persons. Not a multitude of gods, not like Egypt that you've just been released from with a whole abundance of gods that they proclaim to worship. One God, the Lord our God, he is one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love. You shall what? You shall what? Thank you. See, you'll get the hang of it here, right? You shall love, which means to respond, to actually give of oneself, to surrender of oneself, to actually give for the joy, the fulfillment, the pleasure, the betterment of someone else, in this case, God. So, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one God in three persons. You shall give yourself. You shall love whom? The Lord your God. What's missing in there? No, that's not missing in there. What's that? No, you're jumping ahead. Love the Lord your God. What's not in there? To love self before God. What else? This is reviewing. This is recapping. To help you, I had a brown bag that had a pile of dog stuff in it. Love God before everything. Remember we talked about not loving the stuff of God, not loving the gifts of God, not loving the incredible things that God pours out, but learning to love God, the person of God, who he is, one in three, learning to love God. So you shall love the Lord your God and God alone with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your muchness. Excellent. How much of your heart? All of it. How much of your soul? All of it. How much of your muchness? All of it. So how much of you? every ounce, every atom, everything that is in you. I remember last week we talked about how we often come to this passage thanks to our Greek understanding of things, and we divide it into, you know, the emotions and the mind and the body and all this kind of stuff. And the Hebrew actually is just compounding it, saying, no, no, no. It's the totality of who you are. The heart is the inner seat of will, emotions, intellect, everything. So to love the Lord your God with all of your heart is to love Him with the core of your being. To love the Lord your God with all of your soul is to love Him with the core of your being fleshed out into who you are as a person and how you interact with people and with God. And to love the Lord your God with muchness is all of your inner being and all of your responses that flow out of that. And everything you have. And everything that you are. Pause there for a moment. It is not just a call to love God with everything that you have. It is a call to love God with everything that you are. See, and this isn't even where I'm going yet with the sermon. This is all intro stuff yet, right? How often we hate who we are. How often we go through and we nitpick, God, why did you make me like this? God, why did you make me an introvert rather than an extrovert? Or an extrovert rather than an introvert? I don't know why God made extroverts. It just sounds like a mess to me. Why did you make me as an intuitive person rather than a thinker, or a thinker instead of an intuitive person? And how many of us at some point in our life have gone through and said, God, why did you make me like? Am I the only one? No? I'm going to get, because I'm an introvert. And yet, the instruction is to love God, to give of ourselves. To give for the good pleasure of God with everything that we are. And how often do we come to God complaining about who we are? If we're complaining about who we are, we're not loving God with our everything. We're not loving God with our muchness. David says, I am fearfully and, let's say that together, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Let's try that again. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. What if we actually woke up every morning with that little mantra? That doesn't mean there's not junk in us. That's the result of sin. But what if we actually woke up believing that God, the creator of all things, actually created us and that I can honestly say I am fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of God? Could I possibly, if I got that settled in my mind, could I possibly begin to love God with everything that I am? Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 that He wove us together. He created us for good works in advance. That means God designed who we are and what we do in advance of any of our choices. And if we come to grips with that, if we begin to embrace the God who does that, we begin to love more fully. Not only God, but when we're comfortable in ourselves and who God has made us to be, we begin to love others. We begin to love others because it's not a competition now. I love who God has made me to be. I don't need to try to be like you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your muchness. And then we move on to verse 6. And these words that I command you today, which words that he commands? Which words? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your muchness. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. Jump back with me to verse 29 for just a moment of chapter 5. Sorry, we haven't gotten to 29 verse chapter 6. There is no verse 29 chapter 6. The Lord says, "Oh, that they had such a mind as this always." And if you recall, when we came to that, we understand that the word mind there is not the best translation. Instead, some of you were supposed to cross out and mark in blood another word, which was heart. And so then we come to this verse, "Oh, that they had such a heart as this always, to fear me and to keep all my commandments, that it may go well with them and with their descendants." One of the other really interesting things that's in there is the verb that they had such. The Hebrew word there, the Hebrew verb there, is to become. In other words, what God is saying is, "Oh, that they would become a heart." Now, if you carry that on into chapter 6, verse 6, "And these words that I command you today, oh, that they would become on your heart. Oh, that they would transform you from the inside out." God says that with the new covenant, I'm going to take a heart of stone and turn it into a heart of flesh. One that can be molded and manipulated by the hand of God. It can be worked and can create life and pump a newness of life. And see, to become is something that has an active response. Sometimes to become, or I would actually say more often than not, to become relies upon this thing that we don't like called practice. To become relies on me practicing. Let me have the kids come up for a minute. Jonathan is striving to become a what? We don't know. Is this it? This is all that's going to come up, the two of you. All right, that's okay. Can you ride a bike yet, Jeremiah? I will let you negotiate that with those in the back. Yes, you can.
But I'm afraid to fall over if I don't wear training. If I don't do training wheels.
Oh, but can you ride it without the training wheels?
I can ride it my brother Eliza and my sister Eliza thinks I can.
Your sister Eliza thinks you can, huh?
I can.
You can. Now, let me ask you a really important question. When you learn, can you remember back to when you learned to ride your bike?
Yes.
You can? You remember almost the exact day that you started riding your bike?
No.
No. But close to it?
No.
No?
Maybe.
Well, maybe. Okay. So Jonathan, let me ask you this question. Are you paying attention? Are you ready for this one? Okay. Did your parents sit you in front of a textbook and tell you, learn how to ride a bike?
No.
No?
No.
They didn't have you read up on it? They did not. Haley, do you know how to ride a bike? Huh? No? We're going to need to work on that. Does she know how to ride a bike? Yeah. Okay. You don't like riding bike? That's not been a big motivator in your life to ride bike. Huh? Okay. Jeremiah, when you started trying to ride the bike, did you sit down and read a whole bunch about it?
No.
I know what. You guys are a new generation. You guys are the generation what? YouTube. Did you sit down, Jonathan, and watch YouTube videos on how to ride a bike? No. Jeremiah, did you? No. How did you learn how to ride a bike?
By my parents teaching me an experience.
By your parents teaching you an experience. Trial and error. They taught you to? Trial and error might be right, but they taught you to? So how did they teach you? If you didn't sit down and read a book or watch YouTube videos, how did they teach you?
By by telling me how to ride.
So they just stood there and said, put your seat on the seat, put your feet on the pedals, and go.
No.
No? Okay. So what did they do?
My dad did show me one tactic.
He showed you one tactic. Wow. Okay. What was that one tactic?
Gliding.
Gliding? You forgot it until your sister taught you. So explain gliding to me.
You pedal and then you stop.
So you pedal and then you hit the brakes?
No.
Oh.
You pedal, then you stop pedaling and wait for all your momentum to start going out and then keep going.
All of your momentum to keep, okay, wow. This is getting technical now. Are you tracking on this, Haley? You could probably go home after this and ride the bike. Just start pedaling and then just let go and let the momentum carry you. Okay. What else did they do to help you? Are you tracking, Jeremiah? Are you good with this so far?
Well, I do that sometimes too when I'm doing it too fast.
When your feet are going too fast for you? Yeah, then you just stop, right? Some of us big people need to learn to do that too. Jonathan, what else did they teach you to do? Well, yeah, what other instructions did they give you?
Hold the bike.
Hold the bike.
Tell me how to pedal. Kept repeating the same thing over and over again until I perfected
it. Oh, they kept repeating the same thing over and over again until you perfected it. Have you perfected it?
Not quite.
Not quite. So do they keep repeating the same thing over and over to you?
One of them.
Okay. We won't ask which one. Here, I don't want you to get electrocuted. Okay. So you've got this. You're going to go out today and ride your bike, right, Jeremiah? Because he just instructed you on how to do it.
No.
Why not?
Because it might not be sunny enough.
It might not be sunny. It's supposed to be a beautiful day today. I think it'll be plenty sunny. Okay, so we established that your parents were with you, Jonathan, when they taught you how to ride a bike.
Yes.
Yes. And they kept repeating the same things over and over and over until you got it. So the very first time that you got on the bike, one of them did. Okay. We want one or two. How many parents do you have? No, don't they? So do they still remind you? Well, one of them does. Maybe two of them. And do you feel confident on the bike now?
Yes.
Yes? Do you feel that there's still things to learn on the bike?
Yes.
Like what?
I do not want to say.
You do not want to say. Because more than likely the things that you want to learn will result in emergency room visits, right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, here's what we're going to do. I want you to be attentive through the rest of the service as we talk about learning to love God, okay? And how it can be very much like learning to ride a bike. Okay? All right. So you can go back to the back and you can negotiate with Mr. Dammerman back there and your mother about the number of pieces of candy you can have. Good deal?
Deal.
Okay. Jeremiah, you can also, and well as you can, Haley. Okay. I'm still waiting for the day for some old kids to come walking up and sit down with us. That's okay. To become. We don't become by merely ingesting information into our heads. We become by practicing. We become by doing, and just like riding a bike, sometimes we don't do it very well. The great thing is because we have a merciful and a gracious God, He doesn't expect us to do it perfectly. He longs for the day that we will do it perfectly. But He says, I would rather you try and become than sit there and not. And I would rather you try and become and fail at times than sit there until you feel like you have it perfected and mastered and then try. And this is the very thing that I think He's talking about here in this passage. hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your might. And these words that I command you today shall become on your heart. And then we come to verse 7. You shall teach them diligently to your children. And may I just say at this point in time that verse 7 should cause a lot of heartache for most of us, if not all of us. You shall teach them diligently to your children. We've just come off of this idea that that's actually a continuation. It's not a departure from it. It's a continuation when we start talking about you shall teach them diligently. What shall you teach them diligently? His words, and in particular, we're coming right off of this idea of trying and not failing, practice. Well, are you bringing me up some candy, Jonathan? He's going through serving. Excellent. Anybody want a sucker? Raise your hand. Luke? No? Okay. Teach, practice, train what? What does it say in verse 5? Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. So hear, stop there. We already refreshed. I see how well it's working. Hear. The Shema, hear is what? To respond, to listen and to respond. There's action involved. There's life that has to happen. It's not just a sit and listen. It's a respond to what you're hearing. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord. How often do we teach people about loving the things of God and we miss showing them how to love God for who God is? The whole health and wealth gospel. If you love God, you'll be rich and you'll be healthy and you'll be We buy into this, but the reality is we buy into it even in our church. Of course. I would never assume that we buy into that in our church. It's a good thing I have people to keep me humble here. When things are going well, we love God. When things aren't going so well, we blame God. We don't love God quite so much. Why? Because when things were going well, we didn't really love God. We loved what God does, the things that God gives. And so when those are taken away from us, then we begin to wonder about God. How about when we declare it, we paint the pictures when God shows up, right? You know, worship service and man, it's just moving. God's doing great things. And then Monday, you encounter life. Did we really love God or did we love the excitement and the emotions of a corporate time together? How often do we envy somebody that has a particular spiritual gift? We don't love how God made us. We don't love how God has wired us. Teach what diligently? All of this. Teach to have response, not just to ingest it. Teach that God is one God and that he's not Santa Claus God and he's not genie God and he's not policeman God and he's not white-haired grandfather God and he's not... Let's teach who God is. He's one God in three persons. And let's teach to love, to actually surrender for God's pleasure rather than my own. Let's teach to surrender for the glory of God rather than my own.
teach to surrender with all of my being, all of my muchness. It means that we have to teach that to love God is not just an intellectual stimuli. It's not just an intellectual assent. It's just not an academic study. There is a cognitive part to the being, yes? The problem is that modern philosophy, i.e. Greek philosophy, has said that the mind drives the being. Hebrew philosophy says that the heart drives the being. And so we have spent decades, dare I say centuries, trying to academically convince us to love God and have never affected the heart. But if we're going to call God to love us with everything, it means teaching us to love God cognitively, academically, to love God emotionally. Oh, there's a scary word in a lot of churches. Emotions, they're not of God. No, actually, God created them. God is an emotional God. We can go through scripture and we can debate it and argue it and all that kind of stuff. For this morning, for right now, because I'm preaching and you're not, we're going to take and understand that God is an emotional God, which means that when I teach this, I need to not only teach cognitive academic, it means that I need to teach emotions. It means that I need to teach the feeling, the intuitive part of my heart being. It means that I need to teach actions. Because if I'm to love God with all of my being and all of my muchness, it means that I need to teach how to love God with all of my being and all of my muchness. Are we tracking so far? Okay. We have this phrase, you shall teach diligently. And a beautiful, beautiful meaning in Hebrew. This is not anything... There are different feelings on like Paleo-Hebrew pictography and all this kind of stuff. We're not even going there. This is just the straight definition of the Hebrew word. It means to sharpen on a whetstone. To teach diligently is to sharpen on a whetstone. Now, obviously, given the time and place and stuff like that, it probably would have been arrowheads, or it would have been blade, you know, large blades, swords, or something like that nature that would have been sharpened on a whetstone. Now, how many of you guys and gals, I'm using guys generically, have ever sharpened with a whetstone? A lot of you. Somebody teach me. No, I just decided to give up. I just use mechanical sharpeners now, and they work fine. But there is a process to sharpening on a whetstone, isn't there? You don't just go, oh, cool, it's done. As a matter of fact, I've envied my brother-in-law for years because he can do it. He does it well. I mean, his knives are sharp, right? They're excellent. And part of what I learned, you know, you've got coarse whetstones and you've got fine whetstones and you've got all these different qualities and stuff. But sometimes knives get burrs in them. And when you get a burr in it, you know, sometimes you can sit there on a fine whetstone and you can try. And you're going to spend all day trying to sharpen that burr on that fine whetstone. Instead, you go to a course. Now, some of you, depending on your technical nature and stuff, and this is the limited amount that I've learned in the process, there are actually two different angles to a knife blade. Yes? How many of you? Yeah? Okay. And oftentimes we think there's one, but generally on the course, you have one angle, and that's to get out the burrs, it's to get out any divots that might be in the metal, all that kind of stuff, and then you transition to the fine, to slightly different angle to get a really sharp edge on it. What if you took one side of that blade, kept it at the same angle, and just kept going across it with a whetstone? Or taking it across the whetstone, how good is your knife blade going to turn out? You need to study under somebody who sharpens with a whetstone. How good is the blade going to turn out? It's not.
And yet how often when we come to Christianity, spirituality, God, do we teach in one way? Do we try to instruct? Do we try? We take this idea of teach diligently and we go, well, then that apparently means this. And yet, just like with whetstones, there are different grits to them. There are a couple different angles. When we come to teaching diligently, and I recognize that we kind of come into this passage and it starts to talk about, you know, it says, you shall teach them diligently to your children. I'm just going to broaden that, first of all, because most of us, even as adults, still act like kids. So most could be still called children. But I believe this is just true of Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28, we have the Great Commission, right? All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Therefore, go and make disciples. Deuteronomy chapter 6, from here on out, is about making disciples. So I don't care whether you're talking about children or whether you're talking about really old children. I like Casey's version. 1 to 100. All children. 1 to 100 are welcome. It's about discipleship. It's about training. We know passages like Proverbs chapter 27 verse 17. As iron sharpens iron. When you start thinking about sharpening on a whetstone, it's important to keep the whetstone wet. In part, why? Helps keep it clean and heat, friction. And keeps from starting a fire. There you go. If you get enough friction, some of you guys probably, you know, really grind into them. The process of sharpening with a whetstone. Now we could sit here for the next, I don't know, more than 5 minutes. I'm thinking 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and probably go through all the nuances and all the implications. But can it suffice it to say that when God says, you shall teach them diligently, that the implication he's making is that it is more than sitting your kids down and teaching them cognitively, which has been our focus in general in church for at least the last few decades, if not centuries. The cognitive component is necessary and essential, but it doesn't change the heart. And when we call people to love God with everything that they are, they have to see it. So much like teaching a child or teaching an adult, maybe, that would be interesting, to ride a bike. I'm not sure how well I'd do teaching an adult to ride a bike. It's hard to hold the seat, you know, in the bike. Yeah. Don't go there. One of the things we need to begin to realize in this process, where we're talking about the Shema, the loving God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our muchness. The most effective teaching model that is out there is life on life. I hate to say it, it's not Sunday school, it's not small groups, it is not Bible studies, it is not Sunday morning service, it is life on life. As we go through this passage, what we're going to find out is that when God calls them to teach it diligently, we start to see that he's saying, every moment of the day and every activity and everything that you do, would you display for them what it means to love God? So at those moments in time when we're frustrated with the world, how are you displaying to those around you how to love God? There's a guy named Jesus. He spent 3 years spending life on life with at least 12 guys. And even then, one of them didn't get it. But I'm thinking 11 out of 12 is a pretty good success rate.
considering that the still current latest statistic is that 70% of our young people are leaving the church. Has that changed? Do you know, Heather? So I'm thinking Jesus' model, 11 out of 12 is a little bit better than 70% leaving. A 30% success rate. And I know, I've been there, I'm still there, I still live it. All of the excuses that we can come up with. I'm too busy. I don't know how. I don't know what. I don't know where. I don't know when. I don't know. But see, that's the thing. Life on life doesn't have to answer those questions. Because it's life on life. Am I suggesting that we start having communes? I don't know. Maybe that's not such a bad idea. It works for the political way right-wingers. Some of you are slowly kind of like, oh, there it is. I could almost see the idea, like, you know, life on life. We're so into this privatized thing. I mean, come on, I'm an introvert. If anybody's into it, it's me. I want to be alone, not with people. Okay? That's not entirely true. Introverts still like to be with people. But life on life. One of the greatest challenges that I have had recently. I mean, there's a lot of great challenges, but one of them that I've had recently, I shared with the elders this past Wednesday. Caleb and I were down at this little place called IHOP for a young adults conference, and which one? Not the Lewiston one. That one closed. If you're not sure, it was the Kansas City one. It was the Kansas City one. And Corey Russell, right? Corey Russell's talking about prayer. And he's kinda held as kind of a prayer guru, if you would. And he's talking and he goes, you know, one of the most convicting things for him in the past several years, I don't remember the exact time frame, but in the past several years, he's trying to figure out, I'm teaching people to pray. I'm teaching people to intercede. I'm trying to do this, and I'm pouring my life into it, and I believe in it, and I practice it. And yet I'm seeing, if you would, the failure of people to engage in prayer, to engage in intercession. He's like, what in the world's going on? Why have I spent so much time in this process? He's an instructor in it. Why is this taking place? And it's as if this gentle whisper came to him and said, Corey, have you actually ever let people see you pray? See, we have spent so much time teaching people about God, telling people how to love God, giving instruction after instruction, class after class, course after course, and yet we don't let people in to see how it's actually done. I'm going to wrap it up there this morning with two questions. It is far from done. It is far from over. But I want to leave you with these two questions. We'll pick it up here in 2 weeks. No, we're not going to be in Deuteronomy for Easter. I know some of you are heartbroken over that. We're going to pick it up in 2 weeks. We'll pick it up right at this spot again, talking about life on life, discipleship, all this kind of stuff. But I want to, question number one. And I'm going to use a term. It's intended to be unisex, so don't anybody get offended by it, okay? But if I use the term spiritual father, you could say spiritual mother as well. Okay, you'll get the idea. But question number one, and I honestly, I'm going to pause after I ask the question because I want you to write it down. I want you to write it down. I mean, sometimes I just give you the questions, and I hope that you'll
take them and chew on them later, but I actually want you to come up with an answer right now. Question number one, who has been a spiritual father or mother in your life? Who has been a spiritual father or mother in your life? Somebody that has not just told you all about discipleship, told you all about God, told you, but actually embraced you in their life to show you what it's like to love God in the good and the bad. Somebody who has brought you along and said, man, I need to confess to you right now because I shouldn't have said what I just said. Who has brought you into their prayer closet to say, I'm not just going to talk to you about how to pray. Let's pray. Let's do it. I'm not going to show you how to serve in ministry or tell you, or I'm not going to tell you how to serve. I'm not going to give you the 10 best steps on how to serve, but who has actually said, come with me as I go serve. So who has been a spiritual father or mother who has allowed life to rub off on you? Who you got to sit and watch as they're raising their kids and they blow it. Not just from a distance, not from the stories that they've said, but you've been in their home. You've lived life with them. Question number two. This may be a slight bit more difficult. Are we ready? First of all, does everybody have an answer for number one? Let me just be honest for a moment. Your answer, and it is fair enough to say no one. Because what I can say is in the church, there have been far too many people who have not had spiritual mothers and fathers in their life. And all they've learned is what they got at church. All they learned was information. All they learned was the academic cognitive, which again, I'm not bashing. It is necessary, but that's not all there is to it. And that's not all that God calls us to in Deuteronomy chapter 6. So if your answer is no one has, it's okay. Now's not the time to put a mask on to make up a face. It's a time to be honest. Who has been a spiritual mother or father? Does everybody have an answer? I want to see hands. Because I told you, I'm pausing. If you don't have an answer, I'll wait. It's okay. Most of the other people can't see anyway, so it's okay. I'm going to give it like another 30 seconds. There's still a couple people that are pondering. By the way, I confess I lied. I have 3 questions, not 2. Okay. Question number 2. So question number 2 that was going to be number 2 is now going to be number 3. So anything I said in preparation of question number 2 now goes to number 3. So question number 2 is a totally different question. Okay. Question number 1 was who has been, right? Question number 2. Whose life can you look at that you long to have them as your spiritual mother or father? You look at their life and you go, wow. The way they walk, one foot in front of the other. No. The way they walk their spiritual journey. There are various spiritual mothers and fathers in this room. If you came up to me and said, who? I'd be happy to give you a list of names. They might not be happy I gave the list, but I'd be happy to give you a list of names of people. A little personal responsibility now. You've hopefully got a name of somebody that you look to be a spiritual mother or father. Why are they not your spiritual mother or father right now? By the way, that's not question 3 either. That's 2B. Here's the deal. I bless you with freedom. I grant you freedom right now. That if you're looking saying, I've never had a spiritual mother or father, and I look around and I see somebody that is, I bless you to nag them. I do. I bless you to nag them, because we can be so dull-minded that we miss the voice of God inviting us, right, in the process. And sometimes we need somebody to just bang on the door. You remember that story of the persistent widow? Right? Anybody remember that story? Right? What does she do? She keeps asking. She's banging on the door. Leave me alone! No, I won't! Give me some bread. I need it. We should all be in a position where we're going, I need some spiritual parenting. I need it. And if I'm not getting it, find somebody. And nag them, and nag them, and nag them, because none of us in here should be without spiritual parenting. None of us should be. So this brings up question number three. When you look at the relational circles in your life, right now, who is God inviting you to be a spiritual parent to? And I don't believe there's a single one of us in here this morning that can walk away without an answer. If we are serious about loving God with all of our everything and all of our muchness, then there is somebody, they might not be in this room, but there's somebody in your life that God's already put there. It might even be that one person that you go, God, no. Are you kidding me? No. But if you're so thick-skulled that God has to just kind of keep irritating you with that person until you finally go, oh, all right. But who is God inviting to come into your family? And this, again, is not a, let's sit down and have a Bible study together. This is, I want to involve you in my life. I want to have meals with you. I want to hang with you. I want to just spend time and invest in you. And I sure hope that we're going to talk about the Bible. And yes, we're going to talk about God, because if I love God with all of that I am, with all of my muchness, I can't not talk about God. It's not just about getting a new hunting buddy or fishing buddy or quilting buddy or whatever it is. Although that could be a part of it. It's about, I am going to open my life up and be transparent, and you're going to see the good, the bad, and the ugly. Thank God for David. That he put his good, bad, and ugly down in writing for us all to see. I'm not asking you to open up your journals and start reading them on Sunday mornings. But God may ask you to open up your journal for the person that he's invited into your life. He may invite you to pour out more than you ever desired to pour out. But it's time for us to get serious, if you would, about pursuing God with all that we are. And none of us has it mastered. Our spiritual mothers and fathers are gonna flow throughout the course of our lives. Please understand, I want to make a harsh differentiation. I am not talking about teachers. I'm not talking about mentors. I am not talking about coaches. I'm not talking about spiritual directors. I am talking about mothers and fathers who will open up their home and their life for you, and you for others, just like hopefully your own parents would do. For physical, for spiritual, for emotional, for life. Because it's time that we sharpen with the whetstone in every aspect of our lives with one another. If you look around in this room, here's the difficult part about this. And for whatever reason, we get uncomfortable about this. But one of the difficult parts is this. As this takes place, what you're going to find is, well, why is it that so-and-so and so-and-so get together all the time? I wish I could be with so-and-so. It's going to happen. Because if we're sincere about becoming spiritual mothers and fathers, we get our own children. Right? We get our own children. And so, whether you want to call them cliques or, you know, evil stepchildren, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, that takes place in the course of what God is doing, I would hope, and I know jealousy is a bad thing, but yet God is a jealous God, so why is jealousy a bad thing? Okay, enough thinking out loud and rabbit trailing. I would hope that to some degree we would become jealous of each other's relationships. Only because we see what God is doing in that process and go, okay, I need that. I want that. God, what are you doing? So you've got three names written down on your paper, or you should. For the first one, I will count no one as a name. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do with them? We just went across a whetstone about discipleship. And we went very light. Like I said, we'll pick this up in a couple of weeks. We went very light across a whetstone. We just worked on honing a little bit. So what are you going to do with that? I've already told you it is not sufficient for you just to sit and take information in. Shema, hear and respond. God has spoken to us this morning. Not me up here doing this. This is whatever. God has given you names. God has spoken to you. How are you going to respond? Father, we know that the Apostle Paul says you've had many spiritual guides, but very few fathers. And so he goes on to say, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Father, would we look to men and women who are in deep love with you to imitate? May we pursue them as we see Jesus in them. Father, may we open up our lives to some, to those that you invite in the circle, you invite in the process. Father, would you give us a keenness to hear? God, I recognize it would be really easy right now to get into this whole guilt complex of all the people that need spiritual parents. And yet, God, that's not your invitation. Your invitation is to a name that we've already written down. So would you give us a keenness to listen, to hear, to see, to respond? Father, would we have the joy of expanding our family? We have the joy of expanding the depth of our family. In the name of Jesus Christ.